This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear about the increasing number of lawsuits against prison health management corporations, and we'll hear the story of one individual who suffered torturous conditions.
Providing health care for profit means not providing health care at all.
We talk with attorney Myron Beldock, who represented the late Reuben Hurricane Carter.
Wrongfully convicted again and again by a system of criminal justice that remains racist at its core.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, I understand that John Kerry probably said more than he wanted to say and had to apologize about the Middle East peace talks.
You know, it was remarkable. As the talks have gone down the drain, which is what most of us expected, they're normally an excuse that goes on forever for Israel to keep grabbing land, which is, of course, what's been going on. They said they would build another 13,000 units or something in the occupied territories. We've had Rashid Khalidi on there describing how this is just a charade and Israel just keeps taking more land in its so-called heart of Samaria or whatever they call that part. What do they call that part?
And Samaria.
Right. Okay. Well, whatever. So Kerry, I guess, is really annoyed with Israel because whatever his sellout is in terms of the United States, he actually thought he could do something as bad as the deal was going to be for the Palestinians. But Israel has gotten so just outrageous that he actually is saying some things, you know, that you could interpret as giving Israel a warning. And this one, he said after the recent failure, that Israel could become an apartheid state unless it reaches a settlement with the Palestinians, which is, and then he explained that what he's saying is that unless they have a two-state solution, they're going to either be a state with more Palestinians than Jews in it, and the Palestinians will be discriminated against, which makes it an apartheid state, or it will, because there's more Palestinians, and if it's a fair and equal democracy, it will no longer be a Jewish state because the Palestinians will have more clout at the elections and everywhere else than the Jews. So he basically says Israel could become an apartheid state. Now, I did a couple of corrections on that right away. I said, it's really good that he said this, but I would correct could become with the word is. Israel is an apartheid state. But it didn't take long for that statement of Kerry to hit the airwaves, to hit AIPAC and other very, very pro-Jewish state, Israel, Zionist lobbyists, to get him to issue a apology for it. So the next thing I said about when I saw this apology, I said, one thing you know about anybody who speaks the truth about Israel, at least any politician, within a few hours, they have to apologize for saying the truth about Israel. So, and that is exactly what happened. As the Times said, he just went on about how much he loves Israel, how he supported it, and he did not believe that Israel was an apartheid state or intended to become one. He said he did not dispute he had used the phrase, but said it led to a misimpression about his views. That's a George Bush word, a misimpression. In any case, in the long term, a unitary binational state cannot be democratic Jewish state that Israel deserves, or the prosperous state with full rights Palestinian people deserve, he added. Anyway, so he goes on along that line, apologizing for using it. So they took his pound of flesh out of Kerry. And of course, that's not the first time he's actually done something to sort of push back on Israel a little bit. He had said, as the negotiations were floundering, that unless Israel comes to the table on something like a two-state solution, they will be isolated by the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement. That also got him a lot of flack. So you've seen the narrowness of what passes for a politician trying to actually tell the truth about Israel. Then, as this thing has come into the failure, we read our wonderful friend Jody Ruderin in the Times, who's the Times correspondent for the Middle East and Israel. You know, some people say she's actually worse than the last guy. Who was the last guy who had his son in the IDF? Whatever his name was. I read in the article, it's called Arc of a Failed Deal, How 9 Months of Mideast Talks Ended in Disarray. And then, just in case the propaganda gets wrong in the United States, she has this staggering paragraph. Quote, ultimately, the latest round proved the perennial truth with the Middle East peacemaking. Listen again, perennial truth. In other words, true forever, always the case. Washington cannot force an agreement if the parties are unwilling. So in other words, this United States, most powerful country in the world, gives $3 billion a year to Israel in arms and everything else. This country just is like a giant that can't actually push the Israelis to a peace table and even get them to do a very bad deal for the Palestinians. That's the narrative in the United States. It's utterly wrong. Let me tell you something. If Obama said tomorrow we're getting a UN resolution against the settlements, we're going to start asking Congress to cut down the aid, I'm going to do X and Y and Z, you would have Israel at that table very, very fast. If they said we'll support BDS, even for the occupied territories, you'd have Israel at that table very fast. So this Jody Rutter run is just giving an expression to the idea that both sides are equally at fault, they're impossible, and there's nothing the United States can do. In our continuing coverage here, we talk a lot about student dissent on Palestine, dissent in the country on Palestine. And recently, though, we had at least a small victory, but an important one, at least for the students involved, on this issue. Heidi?
It's kind of a conditional victory. Northeastern University is reversing its decision to suspend the group Students for Justice in Palestine until January 2015. That's how long they were suspending them for. So they have now said, if SJP, the group, agrees to take certain mutually agreed on steps, they will reverse that. What they're asking is that the group be on probation for the fall semester. I guess that's this coming fall semester. And students consider this a victory, and I think it is. They had weeks of protests, picket lines, phone calls, petitions, emails. We covered it on Law and Disorder, basically saying this was an affront to free speech and academic freedom. So it's a small measure, but I think an important one, as the group can now continue to plan events and have their presence on campus.
You know, Students for Justice in Palestine have drawn tremendous fire from the Zionists and the campuses. And there's one right here in at NYU, in New York University in New York. Students for Justice in Palestine, I guess during apartheid week on Israel, put flyers or mock eviction notices that were clearly said not real on the top, and they slid them under the doors of everybody they could find, I guess, in two dormitories. Immediately, the story came out that they only selected Jews out to give the mock eviction notices to. A completely false story carried in like the tabloids in New York. Huge amount of pressure on Students for Justice in Palestine. They came back and they pointed out, you know, this is completely false, but that false narrative has been the way that has been characterized, NYU getting called by all its donors, etc. And so it's and those students have, it's not been resolved yet what's going to happen with those students who did nothing discriminatory against Jewish students. And it's going on everywhere right now. I do want to recommend people. The Center for Constitutional Rights has an organization that it's affiliated with. It's called the Palestine Solidarity Legal Support Project. Palestine Solidarity Legal Support. You can go online. You can find the website. It has advice. It has lawyers. One of its main purposes is to defend Palestinian dissent in this country. What I've labeled the Palestine exception to the First Amendment.
Michael Smith, the story we did on Abe Foxman has been getting some traction.
It certainly has. It was on Mondo Weiss and Electronic Intifada. But there was one statement that I made which was really incorrect that I'd like to clarify and withdraw. I said that Foxman, who's the head of the Anti-Defamation League, personifies the Jewish establishment. And I really misspoke, and I should have said he seeks to speak for the Jewish establishment, because it's not the entire Jewish establishment that seeks to deny the Armenian Holocaust. Just the opposite. The Museum of Jewish Heritage here in New York City was founded by Robert Morgenthau and others. And Robert Morgenthau's grandfather was the American ambassador to the Ottoman Empire when the Armenian Holocaust took place. And nobody did more to bring to light that first crime of genocide than Henry Morgenthau. And it was that thought in mind that Robert Morgenthau got others to sponsor and create the museum. And they have regular programs at the Museum for Jewish Heritage on the Armenian Holocaust, and they've been working closely with people in the Armenian community. So I misspoke on that, and I would advise people, if they want to learn more about the Armenian Holocaust, one of the places would be the Museum of Jewish Heritage.
Medical care in private prisons is often provided by a subcontracted for-profit entity. Today, we look at a specific case involving Corizon, a prison health management corporation serving 530 prisons in 28 states. Corizon has been sued for malpractice 660 times in the past 5 years. It's in that context that today we talk about the case of Lawrence Bradley Benetto. He's 67 years old and was out on parole after serving 34 years in California state prisons. Bradley was on 100 milligrams of morphine 3 times a day for surgical complications from a knee injury. While on parole, THC was detected in his system and officers brought him back to prison. But under the care of Corizon, he wasn't given his medication and was forced to painfully withdraw from the morphine. Dr. Robin Anderson is Bradley's sister. She joins us today to talk more about this story. Robin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
Today we're going to talk about a case involving your brother, really a horrific issue of privatization of healthcare in prisons. How are you involved in this case?
Well, my brother, who we call Brad, is currently in Santa Rita Jail, which Corizon is under contract with. So they're the medical providers. He went in on April 17th, and after a week of being in there, my lawyer and my sister said that he was on death's door. And the reason was that he is being forced to withdraw from medications, and his medications are morphine and high blood pressure medication. So he was given no medications for pain, and he basically did cold turkey inside that jail and is still being mistreated there.
And how old is he?
67.
How long was he in prison before he got out, and then what happened to him?
Yes, Michael, this is a parole violation where it is alleged that he might have smoked some pot. He was in prison in San Quentin and some other California prisons. When you do 34 years in prison, you move around. When he was finally paroled, one of the parole board members said, well, we assess the crime that you did to be about 11 years time as appropriate normative time you should have served. One of the other board members said, even in these cases where old lifers like you have done so much time, we're beginning to suggest that they shouldn't have parole. So that's Bradley's condition. And the reason he was on morphine, he was put on morphine in San Quentin because he had a botched knee operation, and he is in constant terrible pain. So this is prescribed medication for a condition, you know, under treatment and certainly involved in, you know, the California criminal justice system.
And during this process, when he was in prison and coming off cold turkey, were you in touch with him?
It was very difficult to be in touch because you have to make an appointment. It's behind a glass. It's one of those phone visit type things. After 2 days, my niece, who lives in the Bay Area, went to see him, and that was Saturday morning. He was taken in Thursday afternoon. She saw him Saturday morning behind glass, and her email to me was so disturbing. It was, he's shaky, he's frail. I don't know how much more of this he can endure. He has been given no medications. I'm afraid for his life. And that was Saturday morning I received that. I called up the jail and I said, I was just in a state, and I said, my brother is ill and he's not getting his medications. This was so disturbing to me because Brad and I have talked about, you know, how he carefully distributes the pills so that he prevents the onset of pain. This, the thought of him in that jail with no medications for that time, just, it was agony. I called the jail immediately and I said, my brother is ill and he's not getting his medications. She put me on hold for a long time. I rather doubt. I don't know what she was doing, but she came back and she said, oh, he just missed pill call. He has them now. I felt relief, you know, got through Easter, and then the lawyer goes to see him on Monday. He has had no medications. The next day, the lawyer filed to compel them to take care of him.
We're speaking with Dr. Robin Anderson, whose brother is in prison, not getting medical care. The medical care providers at the Santa Rita County Jail out in California is a major American corporation called Corizon that has 530 prisons in 28 states under its contracts. And they're the ones that, my guess would be, saving money because they're not doing anything for Bradley. What's your take on it?
I think that's absolutely true. What the jail has told me was that they don't give controlled substances. What my lawyer said is that their policy to save money is that they don't have proper medications. When you call them and try to ask them about his condition, they keep citing you HIPAA law, and they keep saying, oh, but we can't tell you anything because of HIPAA law and about his condition.
Yeah, no, he's in bad shape, and these people, contrary to what doctors and nurses are supposed to do, they're making it worse.
Yes. And their protocols, I did a little research. They have a case against them for killing someone in a jail, and they didn't call an ambulance, and they said it's procedure. But that's not our protocol. And they keep using the word protocol with me on the phone. It kind of rings in my ear, and they kept saying, oh, well, he's on a withdrawal protocol. And one wonders what their protocol could possibly be, but what it seems to me is it's the cheapest thing that they can pretend is medical care, and that's their protocol.
Robin, how many years do you anticipate he'll be in now for parole violation, and are you suing for this medical malfeasance?
Right now, I'm so concerned about his life that it's kind of like one step at a time. You know, my concern now is to keep him alive, and I have been asking people to call the jail because this is a system that's so out of control, you guys, that when I asked the lawyer and the doctor, what can we do now, and they both say the only thing you can do is to call the jail. It's very interesting that they thrive in secrecy and brutality within these places. And the minute it sees a little bit of light of day, then they're worried that there'll be a lawsuit, and then they start to provide care. So my whole point is to inundate that prison in the Alameda County Sheriff's Office that runs the jail to get them to compel them to give him care.
That's the Santa Rita County Jail, and I'm going to give our listeners the number. And when we're through with this interview, Robin, I'm going to call him, and I hope other people do too. Santa Rita County Jail, the number is 925-551-6500. I'll repeat, 925-551-6500. And when you call him, tell him you're inquiring about the situation involving Lawrence Benetto. Does he have a prisoner number that we should cite?
He does. He has a number, which is BKB172.
Say that again, will you?
BKB172. Right. So to answer the question about a lawsuit, it's clear to me that they are violating all kinds of HIPAA laws. I think a lawsuit really needs to be done because on so many counts, not only the care, and I call it torture because not only is it physical they withheld his meds, but it's actually in a legal document now that my lawyer filed that the doctor laughed at him. So you add the psychological torment onto other things. It's so complicated legally because the federal government has compelled the state of California to reduce the number of their prisoners. And what the prison system has done is bounce them back into municipalities and jails. That's why Bradley finds himself in the jail right now where they don't have proper care. Apparently the DA and the judges don't really even know if they could let him go and make their own decision on the case or if it must go back to the parole board. So he's in a legal quagmire that has been created really by California refusing to let people out of prison that they're mandated to do at this point because they have so many excessive sentencing from, you know, drugs and stuff.
To add to that is the whole policy now in this country of privatizing everything, from charter schools to parking meters. And now they've privatized the provision of medical care to people in jail. As a result, you get what we've been talking about here. Robin, thank you very much. We've been speaking with Robin Anderson. She's a professor here in New York City. Her brother, unfortunately, is in jail out in California and become an example of what happens when you privatize services and try to save money and don't give people medical care in jail. So, Robin, thank you very much for, I know it must be very difficult to talk about this, but thank you very much for explaining to our listeners what's going on.
Oh, thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you, Robin.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Robin. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye now.
Class action lawsuits against prison health management corporations are becoming all too common in the United States. There are many cases and stories of gross mistreatment and negligence, which critics say stem from profit-making and cost-cutting protocols. We take a deeper look at the recent litigation involving lawsuits against private, for-profit prison healthcare companies. Joining us are attorneys Anand Swaminathan and Sarah Grady of the law firm Lovey & Lovey.
Attorneys Anand Swaminathan and Sarah Grady, welcome to Law & Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Sarah, I know you have litigated private provider of medical care to prisoners' cases. And I wondered what insights you have on the Corizon Corporation, which provides medical care to 530 prisons in 28 states, including the Santa Clara County Jail.
Sure. Corizon is a, you know, they're a multi-billion dollar company. They have operated under many names throughout the years based through a series of changes in corporate formation, but they operate, as you said, in several different states, and their whole model is really to provide as little health care as possible in order to continue to drive a profit, and they take into account in calculating their profits, you know, how often they're going to be sued, which is several times. And, you know, they gamble, in effect, on how much money they're going to lose in lawsuits, but, and whether that can keep them profitable by continuing to deny care to prisoners housed in the jails for which they provide care. In Arizona, for example, when Arizona first began contracting with Corizon to provide care, in just the first 8 months of 2013, there were 50 deaths in Arizona Department of Corrections custody. And that, I mean, that's just a single state. There are multiple stories of substandard care being provided by nurses and doctors who have not been trained, who have been trained at a suboptimal level and who have not themselves provided any training to officers that work in these correctional settings and are required to provide care to the prisoners housed there.
Let's bring Anand Swaminathan into the conversation. Anand, you litigate these cases out in Chicago. Could you tell us some of the examples of what you think are the most egregious things that you've come across?
What we see is a broad spectrum of issues, both in terms of the types of facilities where these things are occurring and the actual kinds of medical problems that are essentially not being dealt with or ignored. And so these issues are taking place across the entire spectrum of correctional settings. So there are states, counties, and municipalities that are all engaged in this form of privatization, in which they're outsourcing medical care to these private companies. And it includes large prisons, people who are convicted of crimes. It includes people who are being held in custody. And so that includes that includes county jails, which are sort of a hybrid facility that's holding people long-term and people in short-term custody. And it's all the way down to like places like Chicago Police Department lockups, which means in the various police stations around the city, there are lockups, and they hold people there as well. And so there's a broad spectrum across which, you know, when you think of what a correctional setting is, it's everything down to the local police station. And so medical care in the correctional setting is an extremely important concept because it affects so many people. And so we're seeing a lack of adequate medical care across that entire spectrum. And the types of issues we're seeing include all of the types of conditions you see day to day in society. And so certainly we have a number of cases that have to do with acute medical issues, failure to treat specific types of pain, acute injuries, and so on. But one of the things that's particularly troubling is there's a complete failure to treat chronic conditions and some of the chronic conditions that are so prevalent in our society now. And so we had a case involving a young man who was a schizophrenic and a diabetic, and he was a type 1 diabetic. He was young. He was in his early 20s. In that case, we had a doctor and a nurse who essentially could not articulate the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. They were completely ignored the need to provide care, and he eventually died of diabetic ketoacidosis. So that's an example in the diabetes context. We have several cases involving epilepsy where people have seizures. Seizures are a very serious condition that, if it's not treated properly and properly monitored, can have very serious consequences. We've had a case involving a gentleman who died as a result of untreated repeated seizures, and we had a client who suffered major brain damage, now has the mind of a fifth grader after suffering repeated seizures that eventually resulted in a ruptured brain aneurysm. So these are the kind of things that can occur in these facilities when people are not treated.
Yeah, it's really quite extraordinary. Let me just step back and ask you a philosophical, political question, because we're living in the age of neoliberalism where everything is getting privatized. Out in Chicago, they privatize in schools. They even privatize the parking meters. They privatize the skyway that goes from Illinois to Indiana. Now we've got medical providers privatized. What's been the reaction in court? Because this is supposed to be a free market, yet you've got these prisoners who don't have any kind of choice. Have you raised that question in court?
Right. Well, there are some interesting things happening. I mean, you're hitting on some very interesting dynamics. So I think the starting point is that I think we have to look at it and say there's privatization in a number of arenas, and we may agree or disagree with it. But there's one area, it seems to me, where privatization really has no justification whatsoever, and that is in a setting like medical care in a correctional setting, because these people are not consumers. They cannot choose to say, I find your product subpar, I'm not interested in it, I'm going to choose the other guy's product. And so competition or any of the other kind of considerations that are sort of market considerations don't apply here. And so there's really no justification, even under market principles, to justify this privatization of medical care. And what's interesting when you note the courts is that we're seeing, at least in the Seventh Circuit, which is the federal court of appeals where we practice, that we're starting to see pushback on this idea. And it's not just coming from judges that are generally considered on the left or further to the left. It's also coming from judges that have sort of a law and econ sort of approach, and who say, when I look at this from a market perspective, I still can't see a justification for privatization in this context. And certainly they're also considering the kind of fact patterns that they're seeing, the horrific care that they're seeing come to them over and over again in these cases. So what's interesting is we're starting to see pushback, and we're starting to see a very particular type of pushback, and that is courts are starting to attack some of the specific protections that companies are invoking. So there are some protections that governments are entitled to that they can invoke to say, hey, I have a certain immunity from liability. And one of them is called qualified immunity. Another one is the idea that if an individual commits a wrong, an individual correctional officer, for example, the institution can't be held liable unless there's a clear policy that makes them liable. Well, some of those concepts exist to protect governments over a long history for very specific reasons. And the corporations that are taking on this medical care are invoking these government protections in order to protect themselves from liability. And courts are pushing back. And so there has been some recent decisions in which courts are saying, well, some of these protections that apply to governments, you shouldn't just automatically get to have the benefit of those protections. And the reason is because of market forces. So there's a recent case called Filarski from the Supreme Court in 2012 in which they say, hey, maybe you shouldn't get any of these immunities. The quote is, the incentives of the private market suffice to protect employees when a private firm systematically organized to assume a major lengthy administrative task for profit and potentially in competition with other firms assumes responsibility for managing an institution. So here you have courts identifying market forces as a reason to deny some of the protections that these companies are trying to invoke.
We're speaking with two attorneys out in Chicago, Anand Swaminathan and his colleague Sarah Grady. They both litigate cases with the excellent civil rights law firm Lovey & Lovey. And Sarah, I wanted to ask you, have you had any recent victories in this respect?
When we're talking about contracting with these private healthcare companies to provide medical care, whether it's the state or the county or the municipality, they actually cannot contract away their obligation under the Eighth Amendment to, in essence, protect prisoners from cruel and unusual punishment, which includes a responsibility to provide them with basic medical care. That's a constitutional right that the state, municipality, or county owes to the prisoners, regardless of the fact that it has contracted with these private medical care companies.
Well, thank you very much, Sarah Grady and Anand Swaminathan, for being on Law and Disorder. We really appreciate what you do, and every success to you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The story of the hurricane, the man the authorities came to blame for something that he never done. Put in a prison cell for one time, he could have been the champion of the world.
Celebrated boxer and prisoner rights activist Reuben Hurricane Carter died of cancer at age 76. He'd become an international symbol of racial injustice after his two wrongful murder convictions forced him to spend 19 years in prison in New Jersey. Carter was arrested for a triple murder in his hometown of Paterson. He was convicted by an all-white jury, white judge, white prosecutor, and sentenced to three consecutive life sentences. In 1976, the New Jersey State Supreme Court overturned his conviction on the grounds that the authorities withheld material evidence from the defense. But Carter was convicted again in a second trial in 76, and in 1985, that conviction was overturned by a U.S. District Court judge who concluded that the state made an unconstitutional appeal to racial prejudice. In 1988, the Passaic, New Jersey Prosecutor's Office dropped all charges against Carter. We talked today with his attorney, Myron Belduck, who served as his counsel almost from the beginning and was the one responsible for getting Reuben Hurricane Carter out of prison.
Myron, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Now, we're very familiar with the case, but for our listeners who are not aware, can you briefly describe Reuben Hurricane Carter's lawsuits and prison cases?
Well, there were no civil lawsuits. He was a defendant in a criminal case in New Jersey, involved the triple shooting and ultimately three murders of three people in the Lafayette Bar in Paterson, New Jersey, going back to 1966. And he and his co-defendant, John Artis, were represented at the first trial, and they lost. That is, they were convicted, and then Reuben started his campaign to get out of jail and wrote his book, The 16th Round, and ultimately, in 1974, when the eyewitnesses, supposed eyewitnesses, who were not, we claim, recanted, Selwyn Rabb, who was an investigative reporter at the Times, who had worked with me before that on the Whitmore case, Selwyn asked me whether I was interested in representing Reuben, and I had just finished 7 years working on this other case and really didn't want to get involved in another long battle, but I went to see Reuben, and he was charismatic and powerful and a great thinker. He was a very, very, very intellectually strong person as well as being spiritually strong, and so I was drawn into his ambit, and then we went off. The killings were shotgun and pistol shootings of these three people. The original witnesses were
two, I would say, criminal types who were involved in breaking into a factory a block away at the time of the shootings in 1966. And then the first conviction was set aside because it turned out that the prosecution had been trading benefits to those two particular people for their stories, which their original information and all original information described people completely different than Reuben and John. John was a tall young man. Reuben was a very black, very solidly built, bald-headed person. And you wouldn't begin to suspect them from the information about the descriptions of the people who did the killings. One of the people who ultimately died, in fact, two of them saw Reuben and John in the hospital that night, and they did not identify them, and so on. It was almost a typical case, high-profile case, where you get people who are vulnerable and easily manipulated because of their need for their own benefits to falsely testify. Then we set aside the conviction because of learning about the benefits that were given to the witnesses, and went again to trial in 1975. At that time, the atmosphere had changed. There was a new prosecutor. They came up with the theory that this was actually a racial revenge killing. Earlier that night, a white former bar owner had shot and killed the black purchaser of the bar from him. And that was always known, and there was no motive attributed to the killings in the first trial. But in the second trial, really based on nothing but speculation and bias, they argued persuasively to the jury that this was really a racial revenge killing, that the black people went into the white bar, the Lafayette bar, to revenge the killing of the black person by the white former bar owner. And that was one of the ultimate reasons why, many, many years later, the convictions were set aside. But the other reason was the one I was most prominently involved in. At the second trial, Mr. Bello, who was the only supposed eyewitness who testified, there were two of them at the first trial, was being questioned by me on the stand as to why he recanted his recantation. The prosecution had persuaded him to again tell the story he told at the first trial, identifying Reuben and John. And I was trying to establish that they had falsely manipulated him when I was pulled into the chambers along with my co-counsel, Lewis Steele, who represented John Artis, and told that if I questioned him further, the jury would learn that he had passed the lie detector test supporting what he had said at the first trial, supporting his identification. And we did have that test, and it seemed like that was the result, because that's the way it was written. In fact, that was a fraud. It was, just like the first trial, it was a total cheat. The polygraph results were completely the opposite of what they were purported to be. Just before the sentencing in the second trial, 1976, I called the polygrapher, who we thought was an enemy, and he was in a sense, but I had an intro to him from a well-known New York City investigator. And I said, hey, John said I could call you and speak to you and give you my name and that you can rely on me. And then all of a sudden he tells me that the results of the test were opposite to what they were purported to be. You think we could win? Well, we didn't win then. We didn't win for, when was it, how many years? That was 1976. It was 1985 when we finally got a federal judge to recognize these two basic flaws in the prosecution. That was Judge Sarakin, who went over all the years of all the evidence and came to that conclusion that we were essentially cheated. I use the word cheated because that's what it was. And you know, the prosecutors in that case, two of them became judges, rewarded for what they did.
Well, let me ask you. So the two key elements were being cheated. One was the false lie detector results, right. And the other one, say it again, was
that John and Reuben killed the white people at the Lafayette Bar to retaliate from the earlier shooting of a black bartender that night by the white former bar owner. There's no evidence that John or Reuben were involved in being biased against white people, just the opposite. They both had lots of relationships with white people. There was just no evidentiary basis for this argument.
The racial revenge theory.
Racial revenge theory was made up based upon the fact that it had to be because a white person killed a black person, so black people killed white persons. I mean, it was the most flimsy, but in many ways very persuasive. Remember, this is a community that was shocked by the killings. There were three of their own who were killed, one who survived. Reuben was not a popular person. He had been an outspoken civil rights person. There were, you know, false rumors about his being a person who would support killing people, killing white people. I mean, it was the cesspool of rumors without any evidentiary basis that led to the prosecution. And I can tell you, as one who was there, that the entire community, almost in Passaic, New Jersey, like treated us like we were the devil. We were enemies. I mean, it was the coldest community reception I ever encountered any place.
Myron, Michael Smith here. I was a part of his defense early on and went down and met him in prison in Trenton and then again at that minimum security prison that he got into. What confused me about why people would think there was a man who was on the top of his game. He was contender for the middleweight title. He had a wife. He had a daughter. It just didn't make any sense that he would go to a bar that he'd never been to before and kill people he never knew. It was just, you know, utter racist fantasy that they could do that to him.
Well, I of course agree with you. And when you speak of Reuben's public face and notoriety, I didn't know he was charged originally, but I read about the conviction in a newspaper and heard about it on TV when that happened. That was in 1967, I think. And I just thought I was a sports fan, and I thought this makes no sense. How could a person like that? Why would a person like that? How could he possibly do that? He was prominently known, his face was known, and so on and so on. So that's one of the reasons why, same reaction you have, that I got interested in working for Reuben in the first place.
The other thing that was so striking, and Reuben told me, the degree of corruption in the state of New Jersey. I suppose that you could say it hasn't changed much with Chris Christie. But back then, Reuben said that the prosecutor in nearby Patterson County, of course, Reuben was in Passaic County, but the prosecutor in Patterson County was a attorney named Byrne, who later became governor. Reuben said that it was Byrne that arranged to give the lighter sentence to Bellow and Bradley in exchange for their testimony. So Reuben said this thing is corrupt from top to bottom.
Well, I think it was corrupt, but I don't know about the Byrne angle. They certainly gave benefits to both Bellow and Bradley, who had been the original witnesses, by not prosecuting them or not putting them in jail for their various crimes. They were very unreliable witnesses. Bellow was an exceedingly dishonest person, and the whole story about the lie detector test is absurd because he was kind of the immoral kind of person who didn't care about the truth. That was established over the years in many investigations and many aspects of the case.
Let's talk about Reuben and the work that he did, because it seems to me, without being melodramatic, he was truly a tragic and heroic figure. And after, with your great legal skills, got him out of prison, he then moved up to Canada and did work supporting innocent people.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you about that.
I followed Reuben's career afterwards. We would talk occasionally, but Reuben would call every year on the anniversary of his release. He would call us, and I think he called the Judge Sarakin in California by that time. And so we knew what he was doing, and he got dedicated in two different organizations. One was the Association in Defense of Wrongful Convicted People in Canada. He got a group of Canadian do-gooders and freethinkers to join him in fighting to set aside convictions of people who were wrongfully convicted in Canada and elsewhere. And a number of cases, were successful that were brought by that organization. And then he split with that organization and formed a new group called Innocence, something like that. I can't remember the name. And he continued to do that on his own right down to the end of his life. He was interested in supporting a convicted person in Kings County and had just been fighting to help get him out. He, you know, he did what he thought he should do to return to the world, his principled good efforts to set aside injustices. Reuben was an extraordinary person. He was, when I say he was intellectually very strong, remember that he wrote a couple of books, but it was not just that he wrote the books. He participated with us in the defense of his case with Leon Friedman of Hofstra, who joined us after the second convictions, and with Lou Steele. He would vet the briefs that we sent. We used to have a relay between Rahway Prison and my office, sending him drafts, and we would get the comments back. He was a very unusual client.
He also took principled stands while in prison, refusing to wear a uniform or to work at prison jobs. Was he well regarded inside?
He was kind of a hero to a lot of the prisoners. Reuben, as you say, refused to act like a prisoner because he wasn't anyone who was guilty, he said. So he didn't eat prison food, he didn't take prison assignments, he didn't wear prison clothes. And somehow or other, he was able to pull that off. Some of the guards even supported him because they recognized his principled stand. Early on, when one of our appeals failed after, I think it was one of our appeals, I can't remember whether it was one of the earlier appeals, Reuben essentially had an emotional breakdown in prison, a mental breakdown, and he was hallucinating and just like beyond the depths of despair. And there was a white, well-known because of his crime, prisoner who took Reuben aside. They were both leaders. One was the leader of the whites and one was the leader of the blacks in the prison, and nurtured Reuben through that time, and he came back even stronger. You can't imagine what a strong person he was. After the second conviction, when our lives were so bleak, I mean, we met in the prison, in a basement prison in New Jersey, and we were weak in spirit, and you know, where were we going to go now? And somehow pulled up our socks and went forward and reestablished our case. But after that second conviction, Reuben did an analysis of all the evidence at the second trial on big, big boards with little flip cards so that you look under what the prosecution claimed and what the evidence, the impeachment evidence was. I still have it. It's like a unique document. It's like 4 by 5 feet wide and has many, many boxes, and that's when I knew he was really coming back. He, as I said, he was a participant in his case as no other client I've ever had.
He truly was extraordinary. He didn't get much of an education. He was in juvenile prisons as a young person. His father was a deacon or a minister in the church, I think.
Yes.
And he had a real moral sense to him. When Malcolm X came around to Reuben recognized Malcolm's moral authority, identified with him. I think that may have been one of the things that got him into trouble, because Life magazine wrote an article.
Yes.
Linking
yes,
the two.
He was portrayed as a dangerous rebel, and that certainly didn't make him popular in the community in Paterson, New Jersey, at least on some elements of the community. I mean, he had a lot of white friends too. People think of it as being another time. I've been practicing law long enough, so I don't think anything changes. I mean, the same kind of bias runs deep throughout the community. It's just masked somewhat differently, as we see from current events.
Myron, you've had some other significant cases. Can you talk briefly about your representation of one of the so-called Central Park joggers?
Well, we are representing in the office. My partner, Karen Dippold, and I are representing Yusuf Salam and his family. And my partner, John Moore, is actually, along with a number of other attorneys, representing three of the other former defendants. So we have 4 out of the 5 of the current plaintiffs being represented in our office, that we've been doing it since 2002, more or less.
It's a damage case, right? I mean, they've all been released.
It's a damage case.
Their convictions overturned. Yeah.
That's right. Well, the convictions were overturned when Reyes, Mateus Reyes, came forward and his DNA matched. But the prosecution, well, the Corporation Counsel now, like substitute of the prosecution, have never given up the claim that somehow the former defendants, now plaintiffs, were involved. And either they came upon the scene after Reyes attacked, or they came on the scene before Reyes attacked, and they attacked the Central Park jogger. So it's like an endless battle. I mean, that's another 12, 13 years that we've been at this, trying to get compensation for the young men who spent between 7 and 12 years, depending upon which one was a juvenile and which one was not, in jail for crimes they didn't commit.
But now on that issue, I know you guys are trying to get a settlement with the city, and de Blasio, when he took office, and I don't know what you can speak about, but took office, said he wanted to settle the Central Park jogger damage cases.
Yes, and there are ongoing discussions now, but they've been going on for quite a while, and we're still not there. We're waiting for a good faith offer by the city, and it may never. We hope it will come.
I also recall in the beginning of this interview, you mentioned the George Whitmore case. I knew very little about it. I read this big, thick book that began with George Whitmore and the career girls murders, I guess, in the 50s. Is that right? I think so.
In the 60s.
In the 60s. And they convicted an innocent black man in those cases.
I mean, it's another typical case. I mean, you've got sensational case. Public reaction, of course, is extraordinary. They have to get somebody. They've got this 19-year-old kid who was dyslexic, who was over in Brooklyn one night, and at that same night there was an attempt to rape a woman, an attempt to sexually assault a woman, and policemen came upon the scene and saw the attacker, and the attacker ran away. The next day, that same cop saw George Whitmore standing on the corner in the same neighborhood. George was there for another reason. He was trying to get a job with his brother. Didn't recognize him, of course, didn't match the description, and in a series of extraordinary events, he ended up being questioned in the precinct by a group of detectives, including those on the case in Manhattan involving what they call the career girls, two young women who had been murdered and raped in the process in Manhattan. And he ended up confessing to three crimes: the attack on the woman in the alleyway next to her building the night before, the attack on the women in New York, and another third rape murder of a woman in Brooklyn. All of it was completely false. And, you know, in the Miranda decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, it was a footnote of note to refer to the false confessions. I mean, in the career girl cases, there was like 70 pages, roughly 65, 70 pages of information that only the killer would know. And, of course, it was all fed to him. It's all very disgusting, because it happens over and over again that bad police investigation works to the great harm of people who are falsely charged. There are many stories in the Whitmore case, one or two worth telling, perhaps. It turns out on the day that the two girls in Manhattan were killed, and it turned out later to be found out that George Whitmore was in Wildwood, New Jersey, 6 hours away by car, in the, I guess, the city hall, in the company of the police chief and various other people, watching Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. So he could hardly have been in New York. And ultimately, I handled the last of the cases, the one involving the woman who was supposedly attacked and about to be raped in a hallway. And ultimately, we got that set aside when we found a witness in Puerto Rico who was able to give contrary testimony. But in going to Puerto Rico to try to find the witness who was the sister-in-law of the woman who was attacked, Selwyn Rabora and I were at a hotel wondering how we're going to find this person. We learned that she was in Puerto Rico. We learned she was in San Juan area. And I said to Sylvan, in effect, you know, I do what I always do. I'm going to ask the next person who comes by. I would go out in the street and ask people, witnesses. I used to do that kind of thing, you know. And so I turned to the next person who came by, who was the busboy bringing us our fruit for breakfast. And I asked if he knew so-and-so. And it was his wife.
Amazing.
Amazing story. It was his wife. They were separated, but he told us where we could find her. You know, you make your luck in these cases. You just have to, like, forge ahead and keep believing that if your cause is just, you're going to get a result. It's not always true, of course, but we were lucky in the Whitmore case.
I think it's implicit in what you've said, but can you speak briefly about what kind of inspiration you derive from your clients?
Well, you know, we always want to believe that we are working for people, that we are serving people who are innocent. And I know that's not always true for lawyers, but I've had a series of clients who have been not just innocent, but who have been inspirational because of their insistence, despite the fact that they could get out of jail, for example, that they're not guilty and that they ultimately will prevail. I have one right now I've been waiting for, a decision in the Second Department in state court in New York, and I'm waiting for their integrity unit in Kings County to revise the case. This man has been in jail since 1992 and could have gotten out of jail 10 years ago, and doing the same kind of stance that Carter had taken. He refuses to admit that he's a sexual offender. He could have been let out and on parole 10 years ago. His insistence on being an innocent person and will not compromise with the system is the kind of inspiration that, you know, pushes us on as lawyers. If the client can do it, then we should, too, put out to the utmost. I guess that's the best answer I can give you.
Thank you so much, Myron Baldock. It's an honor to talk to you.
It really is. I mean, it's extraordinary, your career and what you've done, and, of course, what the system remains, unfortunately.
Well, I'm a long time ever supporter of WBAI, so I appreciate the compliment.
Thank you, Myron Baldock, for being on Law and Disorder.
Take care, everybody.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye. Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.